Today we're concerned with the first of the trainings that constitute the Buddhist path to enlightenment, the first of three trainings, the Tri Shiksha, to give them their Pali name. And that is the trainings concerned with ethics or morality. The Sanskrit word is Shila, Pali is Sila. And of course the language of ethics, morality, can be a bit difficult for some people, it seems. In this day and age, perhaps it evokes in people's minds authority figures, parents, teachers, priests, religion, God, which they don't believe in anyway, but might still be lurking in some strange way, non-way. Perhaps hypocrisy, all that sort of thing. So, ethics, morality, do we go there? Sometimes the language of ethics or morality can evoke for people a feeling of having to sort of knuckle down to a set of rules which stop one from doing what one really wants to do. That's the way we can perhaps have the associations with morality. There's something we really want to do, but we're prevented from doing it. Well, if that's in your mind, refer back to yesterday's talk and discussion. And remember that the Buddha's teaching, the Dharma, has been taught to help us to grow, to mature, to ripen towards enlightenment. It's concerned to expand and transform consciousness. It's concerned to bring about liberation from all restriction in the end. So Buddhist ethics, Buddhist morality is practiced for that end, that purpose. So We might need to remind ourselves of that on a regular basis when we're engaging in the disciplines of Buddhist practice. It's there to foster, to bring about growth and development towards enlightenment. And we need to connect the discipline, the training, with that vision and see what the connection is. One of the very interesting things about the Buddha himself is that after his enlightenment, he didn't immediately dish out a set of rules and commandments. And enlightenment wasn't a sort of issuing from some kind of cosmic nirvana, a whole set of commandments which he marched out the forest with and presented to mankind. In fact, the earliest teachings of the Buddha to his disciples doesn't really say very much about ethics, skillful behaviour. Didn't really need to, because the Buddha and his earliest disciples were already leading a very pure life. They were wanderers and they'd already got a sort of very simple, essential kind of ethical code. They were living a pretty blameless kind of life. So as far as we know, the very earliest teachings don't really concern themselves with ethics that much. They point really directly to the state of enlightenment. That's the impression you get. The Buddha can just go straight to the heart of the matter with his earliest disciples. If there is any ethical things, it's more to do with sort of subtle tuning up. But as time went on, the Buddha had more to say about ethics, had to talk about behaviour, and how people could live. Quite simply because he encountered people who needed clear teachings about that. So he applied his vision of life to the whole topic of behaviour, of how to live, what to do, and a much clearer training on how to act, in how to progress to enlightenment from where they actually were, from where the people actually were, who he was talking to. And what emerged especially was different sets, probably over time, of what we call precepts. The traditional word is sikkhapada, as in, if you remember the five precepts that we chant after the refugees, remember sikkhapadam. Well, that's sikkhapada in its particular grammatical form. So it's sikkhapada. Shikshapada is the Sanskrit for the linguists among you. So sikkha, it means training. And pada means item, though it could mean principle. One way of translating sikkhapada is training principle. So not rule, not commandment. That's not You know, that wouldn't that sort of language wouldn't correspond to the original language. Training principle. So it immediately gives you a different idea of what you're concerned with. You're concerned to train in a principle, or train to move towards an ethical ideal, an ethical principle. So the most basic of the, when I say basic, I don't mean by that, you know, that they can be dispensed with. The most basic, and in a way, perhaps from a certain point of view, the most profound, are the five training principles, the five precepts that we chant every night in the puja after we chant the refuges. So it's very important to understand, not rules or commandments, but something we train in to help us to grow towards enlightenment. So the five precepts have two aspects: a negative aspect, what you're abstaining from, and a positive aspect, what you're moving towards. So we abstain, we undertake the training principle to abstain from harming living beings, and the ethical principle is there is loving kindness. We abstain from taking the not given, and we have the principle of generosity. We abstain from sexual misconduct, and we have the positive principle of contentment. We abstain from false speech, and we have the positive principle of truthfulness. We abstain from drinks and drugs that intoxicate the mind, and we have the principle of mindfulness. So in practicing the five precepts, we're looking to move away from behaviour that causes suffering to self and other. Behaviour, therefore, that limits us and restricts us, that causes us to fall away from growth towards enlightenment. And we're looking to develop, to cultivate qualities, behaviour that brings happiness, well-being to self and other, that promotes growth towards enlightenment. In fact, practicing the precepts is actually a very advanced practice. Strange to say, it's an elementary practice, but it's also quite advanced, because actually we're enacting enlightenment itself when we practice the precepts. Although it's the beginning of the path, in a sense it's also the end of the path. So what do I mean by that? Well, it's said that an enlightened man, a Buddha, is naturally ethical. Because of his realization of the way things are, that results in naturally ethical behavior. He doesn't have to try to be ethical. He just is. That's the way he expresses his attunement with the way things are. So it's said that an enlightened being cannot harm living beings, can only love, cannot steal, take the not given, is naturally generous, cannot commit any form of sexual misconduct. In fact, never wants to have sex at all. And so naturally contented. Cannot lie or speak falsely. So he's always truthful. Never uses intoxicants. And is naturally mindful and aware all of the time. So in training in the five precepts, we're aligning ourselves with enlightenment. We're bringing the Buddha into our life in a very direct way. Sometimes later Buddhist texts speak about developing Buddha pride. Buddha pride, which isn't arrogance. It's a sort of very positive state of self-respect, if you like. You're about to do something unskillful. Let's say you're about to speak harshly to someone because maybe they've been harsh to you, and you know, quickly there's this awareness that arises, well, how could I do that? I'm a follower of the Buddha. I'm aspiring to become a Buddha. How could I possibly speak in this way? So you don't do it. So it's a healthy pride that you have, a sort of Buddha pride, that you're part of, if you like, of the Buddha lineage, the Buddha family. And that can prevent unskillfulness. And of course, this is a great support to one's spiritual aspiration, one's aspiration towards enlightenment. And it's very important to bear this in mind. If there's no aspiration towards enlightenment, we can't really understand the nature of Buddhist ethical practice. We're going to get it wrong. we're going to turn it into a set of rules or turn it into an authority or get very legalistic about it. Buddhist ethics is founded on the fact that you want to gain enlightenment. You know, you're very serious about that. Buddhist ethical practice then comes from inside you. It comes from you as an individual. You have a vision of what you can become, and you live for that, from that. So for this reason, Buddhist ethics is described as an ethics of intention. And actions are evaluated according to the state of mind with which they're performed. And the key words here are skillful, kusala, and we can remember that very easily because we have an order member here called kusala, the embodiment of skillfulness. So the key words here are kusala, skillful, and akusala, unskillful. He's kusala, not akusala. So kusala means skill, art. So a skillful act is action expressive of a mind free of ignorance and confusion, free of craving and grasping, free of hatred and aversion. More positively, a skillful act proceeds from a clear mind, a mind set on enlightenment, that is clear about the way things are, a mind that is content and generous and friendly and loving. So if you're acting with that mind, you're on the right track. If you've got that intention, you're on the right path. But if the mind is unskillful, and of course this demands, you know, great honesty, you know, within ourselves. If the mind is confused, blind, opinionated, you know, if it's confused, blind and opinionated, it's very difficult to see that it's confused, blind and opinionated. You might need your friends to point that out to you. If it's filled with craving, grasping, hatred, aversion, you're definitely on the wrong track. You're going backwards. So this demands a lot of us. Buddhist ethics is actually a very demanding practice. You know, it demands that we're very honest. It demands that we have a lot of integrity. And it has all sorts of subtle levels to it. So this is where the precepts, the training principles, are very important, because they give us a framework, almost like a sort of checklist. Give us things that we can actually work with. They give us obvious supports, obvious things to avoid, obvious things to develop. And this just makes things a lot easier, a lot clearer for us. So let's go through these five great training principles. So first of all, abstention from harming living beings, or loving kindness, with deeds of loving kindness. So in many ways, this is the most important precept of all. This is the fundamental precept. There's a little saying, those who go for refuge to the Buddha give up harming, give up killing. Those who go for refuge to the Buddha are non-violent. That if you really do commit yourself to gaining enlightenment, the immediate effect is to give up harming and to practice loving kindness. And it's sometimes said, well, look, if you find five precepts too many to observe, you can take the first one, because if you take the first, you'll probably observe the other four. And probably we'd all agree with it, that harming others, physically harming them, verbally harming them, emotionally harming them, through any kind of manipulation, that kind of thing, emotional blackmail and all that kind of thing, that is, of course, wrong. You know, we'd all probably agree with that. But why? Why is it such a bad thing, this harming of others? Why? And why does it obstruct our spiritual progress towards enlightenment if we harm other living beings? You know, obviously it's hurting them. We don't want to do that. But why does it get in the way? Well, it does so because it disrupts and breaks our fundamental solidarity with other living beings, our fundamental connectedness with other living beings. And when we do that, we not only damage them, but we damage something fundamental to ourselves, in ourselves. Damaging another is actually damaging ourselves, damaging the life within ourselves. One of the great insights of the Buddha, which is drawn out very fully in later Buddhist traditions is that all living beings are profoundly interconnected. Yesterday, in trying to sort of point to the Buddha's insight, we saw that all beings are a flow of conditions, sort of flow of energy, if you like. And that means, actually, they're not separated from one another. That's one of the implications of that particular teaching, that we're actually not separated. We're deeply connected, deeply interconnected. And if you harm the life of another, you do something to yourself. You damage yourself. You kill off something in yourself. Even destroy within yourself a sensitivity to life. You destroy something quintessentially human when you harm other living beings. You know, and you notice this if you ever meet people who've lived violent lives, violent to other human beings or violent to animals. There's something sort of dead in them. There's something not right in them. You've noticed people starting to get very paranoid if they've lived a life of violence and even go a bit mad. They kind of create a hell, not just for others, but for themselves as well. They become completely alienated in the end from reality, from the way things are. That's quite an extreme example, but I think that you know, one of the things we need to do in relation to this first precept is to start developing a far greater sensitivity and awareness to the life around us. And it could be that we're actually insensitive and we're not aware of that. But practicing this first precept, you start to develop a much greater sensitivity. Yeah, so practicing this precept means developing this sensitivity to all other human beings, to all animals, to all life, without exception. One of the things it means is learning to develop profound imaginative identification with others. This is a very traditional Buddhist practice of all the schools of Buddhism, and it's the basis of the Metta Bhavana meditation practice. We need to have a, you know, wake up to the fact of ourselves as a living and growing being. You know, we need to become very well aware of that there are things we want and we sort of need as a human being. You know, we want to avoid suffering. We want to be happy. We want to be well. We want to live and be well. We want to feel safe. We want to feel secure. We want things to go well for us. That's what we really want when we get down to it. You don't have to kind of, you know, pump yourself up to kind of do that. Actually, all the time, you know, we're living in a way that involves a lot of self-cherishing. This is, you know, quintessential to our human life. Well, one of the things we learn to do in practicing the first precept is realise, well, others are exactly the same in that respect. There's absolutely no difference between ourselves and all other forms of life. All others want that. All others want to be well. They want to avoid suffering. All others want to feel safe. They want to avoid feeling insecure. All others want to live. They don't want to die, unless, of course, they're in very extreme states. But we can be sure of that we're the same as all others in that respect, that we want to be happy, we want to be well, and we want to avoid suffering and pain. So we start to learn to treat others in the way we would treat ourselves. And it's this old tradition of what they call the golden rule, you know, going back to Aristotle, you know, this treat others as you would treat yourself. And in this way you develop an identification with all life around you. You develop an awareness, a sensitivity, an interest in them. And you avoid causing them any kind of harm. You avoid doing anything that destroys life. So this has implications, this, you know, practicing in this way, developing in this way. Buddhists, for example, you know, don't have abortions and wouldn't encourage abortions. They would, because they want to promote life, and that's potential life. Buddhists would be vegetarian, somebody observing this first precept, even vegan. I don't know if they're up the road at the moment, but if you see the cattle in the fields, well, it does make you reflect on, you know, the suffering that they're going to face, you know, for the dairy industry, you know, and if you drink milk and things like that, well, that will affect you. I mean, it certainly makes me think about it, about that whole area. Observing this precept, one of the implications of it is that you're against all kinds of warfare, the production of weapons, that you're very concerned about the destruction of the environment. You want to care for the environment, want to minimise damage to the environment. You know, obviously, this is a very, very big topic, but it's a question of really, you know, looking at ways we can all minimise the harm that we do to others. I mean, just living does involve causing some harm. It's sort of unavoidable, but you really try to minimise that and really practice a much greater sensitivity and awareness of the life around you. You have a desire to cherish all life. And more positively, you develop loving kindness. You know, you do deeds of loving kindness, actions expressive of loving kindness. And it's this loving kindness is not any kind of sort of sentimental feeling. It's actually very profound. You know, when you really identify with the life of others, this loving kindness is a very maturing and cherishing kind of love, which has the effect of inspiring others to grow and develop as living beings, as human beings. And you find ways in your life to do that. You might, you know, might be expressed in your livelihood. You know, it might be some sort of vocational livelihood that you take up to really bring people on in one way or another. Obviously, the Metta-Bhavana meditation is a very important practice here, to develop our practice of this first precept, so that our behaviour will express such loving kindness. And of course, the more our behaviour expresses loving kindness, the easier it is when you actually come to do the meditation itself. So that's the first precept. Then the second precept is abstaining from taking the not given. And it's the principle of generosity. So abstaining from taking the not given means not stealing, not defrauding others. And that kind of behaviour is unskillful because it's based on a state of craving, acquisitiveness. It's a very self-centred state we're in if we take the not given. And again, we're damaging that sense of solidarity with all life. Stealing, taking the not given, actually harms others because their property or their money, as far as they're concerned, is an extension of them. I remember when I lived in a Buddhist centre and it was broken into, and you know, we were pretty poor, but and lots of our things were stolen. I mean, they very thoughtfully moved the Buddha image aside. They didn't take the Buddha image, they seemed to sort of put it aside and nick everything else. It was quite sweet, really. They must have thought the Buddha might punish them or something. But I can remember when I went into the centre, I felt really sickened at seeing, you know, this place that I loved so much, you know, being damaged in this way. I mean, it really felt like a violation, and I'm sure, you know, you've had that feeling when things have been stolen. You know, it's awful. So, you know, well, you need to. We need to realise. Well, that's the effect on other people. And of course, people try to rationalise this. I mean, I've been with people. Sometimes people on a Buddhist retreat talking about this, and you know, they've thought nothing of, you know, ripping off train companies or you know, that sort of thing. And they say, "Oh, property is theft, man. You know, they're just attached. You know, it's teaching them a lesson." But that's just rationalising your insensitivity. And it's as simple as that. There's no virtue in it at all. The positive aspect of this is open-handed generosity. Just giving, just sharing the good things you have in life with others. You know, you don't need. don't need to have very much to do this. You can share so many of the good things you have with others and just give them to others so that they feel enriched by that. So it's not enough to not steal. It's not enough to not take the not given. That's the sort of bare minimum. We also need to practice generosity, which is actually a very, very powerful practice. Generosity is a very powerful way of stepping out of self-centeredness and self-fixation and a sense of being separated. You know, sometimes people complain of being, oh, I feel so lonely and, you know, I'm all in myself. And you kind of look at them and they never give. They never sort of step out. They never, you know, they never give to others. I mean, my mother lived next door to a for years and years and years, you know, about more than 50 years, I think. About 50 years next to a woman who, you know, was always complaining about being lonely, but she was incredibly ungenerous. She had this wonderful apple tree full of the most fantastic cooking apples, but she'd never let my mother, who loved to kind of, you know, make apple stew, and she would have done it for her. She never let my mother in to kind of collect up the apples that were just rotting on the ground. My mother had to kind of, you know, take the windfalls from her garden and things like that. And she'd say, Daisy, you know, why don't you let me pick the apples? And I'll make apple. No, I don't want to, you know. And then Daisy would worry, you know, would say, nobody loves me. And, you know, well, get real. You know why? Even when the people were being really generous to her. Well, you see it among Buddhists as well, you know, people saying, you know, people don't want to talk to me, but they're kind of in themselves, up their bums. But anyway, so generosity, a very powerful practice, you know, looking out to others and stepping out, and it's a mudra. That's the mudra of generosity. It's a wonderfully straightforward gesture like that, the open palm, and that's so expressive. That's a very powerful effect when you do that. What the Buddha saw, in reality, self and other are not ultimately separate. We have this idea of a real separate self, here and others there. I'm here, you're there. Actually, if we were to analyse that in reality, we wouldn't find it. We wouldn't be able to find a fixed self here and a fixed other there. You know, you could have a good look, but you'd never find it. So we need to heal that splitting off, that subject-object dichotomy, as it's called. Not through fancy metaphysics and waffling on about non-duality and, again, disappearing up our bums. That's a fixation. But through generous deeds, through actual deeds of generosity. You know, giving, you know, moving out towards others. There's so many things you can give. Money, time, energy, education, courage, giving people courage and confidence. Buddhism even says you can give life and limb if necessary, not as some sort of grand gesture, but you might decide that that's the best thing to do in the general scheme of things. And the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, that's regarded as a fantastic gift, giving people the means to practice, if you have it, that is. So there's so much that we can give and pass on to others that can have such a positive and powerful effect, you know, on them. So we try to enrich the lives of others. And of course that creates a great sense of richness and expansiveness in oneself. You know, the sort of wealth mentality is the generous mentality. I remember an older member friend of mine telling me about his Irish uncles, and he said they were incredible, these uncles. They'd come and see us when we were kids, and I thought they were millionaires, because they when they left, they'd put their hand in their pocket and they'd give you, you know, coins, notes, you know, which seemed like a fortune. And then later on I discovered they were kind of paupers. They had hardly anything, but they had this rich and kind of expansive attitude. So generosity creates this sort of sense of inner wealth and expansiveness. It's something you see very strongly in the Buddhist East. I think it's an Eastern tradition generally, but in India when I was with mixing a lot with Indian Buddhists who were very, very poor. The generosity was extraordinary and hospitality. And, you know, I've heard some people in the West say, oh, well, it's just cultural. Well, it might be strongly cultural, but it's a lot more than that. And it's a very healthy culture, any culture that has that kind of generosity. And, you know, if I was giving a talk somewhere and, you know, even very, very poor people would come and give me just, you know, grubby rupee notes and coins, or sometimes even a lot more than that, and just wanting to express their appreciation, and, you know, in that very direct way. So generosity has a very, you know, powerful effect. I mean, just try it. Think about this practice. Because also generosity are, you know, generous acts are acts of loving kindness as well, in a very practical way. I mean, think about, you know, the state of your generosity, if you like, and maybe have a week where you really intensify your practice of generosity and see how it feels, see what it does to you. Thirdly, abstention from sexual misconduct, or the principle of contentment, stillness, simplicity, and contentment. Now, of course, the area of sex, sexuality, sexual relationships can be very, very fraught area for some people. And all sorts of feelings get stirred up by this topic. I can remember when we've done a study here on the precepts, and we've had a day or two studying the third precept, you get very, very animated conversations. It's very interesting, seems to stir up a lot of energy. All sorts of feelings get stirred up by this topic. Guilt, irrational guilt, inadequacy, desire. People usually, after a study of the third precept, have very, very vivid dreams of one kind or another. Well, first of all, to say, just to try and cut through any kind of confusion that might be around, in Buddhist tradition, guilt, irrational guilt, but just simply because we have sexual feelings, has absolutely no place. I mean, you know, Buddhist cultures are not guilty cultures in that way, which seem to be the case in, can be the case in, I know for some people with a strong Christian or Judeo-Christian past, I mean, lots of guilt about sexual feelings, just sexual feelings. Well, in Buddhist tradition, it's just regarded as a part of, you know, being alive. You know, you have sexual feelings. It's an appetite. In fact, irrational guilt, feeling bad about having those feelings, would be regarded as an unskillful state. Irrational guilt is actually a something preventing your positive growth. But let's not go to the other extreme either. Buddhism definitely doesn't say that sexual feelings are sort of deeply spiritual. They're not that either. They're a form of craving, after all, and craving can hold you back. But the Buddha recognises that most people aren't going to give up sexual activity. That's just not going to happen. You know, his monk disciples were celibate, or supposed to be celibate, but most of his disciples weren't monks, so they were going to be engaged in some kind of sexual activity. I mean, just to say, by the way, just how cool about these things the Buddha was. One of his main lay disciples was a courtesan named Vaishali, you know, who became very wealthy, providing various kinds of pleasures to the gentleman of Amrapali. Her name was Amrapali, but she provided lots of services to the wealthy men of Vaishali. And the Buddha had no problem in her being his disciple. I mean, he didn't sort of tick her off or anything like that. You know, it was it seemed to have been quite a sort of straightforward, civilized arrangement at that time in ancient India. So, anyway, most people aren't going to give up sexual activity, not for a while anyway. So it's more a case of making making sure that sexual activity doesn't cause harm to self and to others, doesn't obstruct spiritual growth. I should also make it very clear that the Buddha makes no judgments at all Buddhism makes no judgments at all about whether one is heterosexual or homosexual or anything like that. Traditionally, there are three kinds of sexual misconduct that are mentioned. First of all, rape is sexual misconduct. Forcing yourself on someone when they don't wish it. That is obviously unskillful. That causes harm to them. It's an act of violence, obviously. Secondly, adultery is regarded as sexual misconduct. Breaking up someone's marriage or their partnership causes harm in so many ways to the other person's partner, to them, and to you, actually, because usually adultery involves deception and falsehood, and it's very painful, disrupting and confusing. We can end up living a lie. It's much better to keep things as clear and as straightforward as possible. Thirdly, abduction. This might sound extreme, but the Buddha had to talk about this because, it went on in ancient India and still does. Still does go on, goes on in different parts of the world. Young women, girls being abducted from their families and forced into marriage. And of course, this causes immense suffering. And obviously, there are many other examples of this kind of thing which the Buddha would definitely be against. Probably, I would imagine none of you are involved in any of these kinds of things. But we need to look at the principle. We need to make our sexual relationships as clear as possible. As clear as possible. For example, sometimes we can promise all sorts of things to get what we want in a relationship, sexually or, physical intimacy and all that sort of thing. Or we can go along with the other person's expectations, which we don't really intend to meet. And it all gets very fraught, it all gets very confused. And sometimes we're not even clear about all this, but that's actually what's going on. A lot of tensions can go on in sexual relationships because both parties are not clear. They're not really being honest about what they want. Or if they are, they're both so, they want such different things that it isn't going to work. So we need to tidy all this up. Tidy up our sexual relationships. See the other person as a person, as a living human being. Be concerned about their growth. Not just a hook for all our romantic projections or a body to use. But just be as clear as possible. The more we do that, we actually might find that our sexual craving begins to fall away. And desire starts to become meta and starts to become loving kindness, which can create difficulties, but of a different kind. Sometimes it can happen. To be honest about it, you can be in a sexual relationship with somebody, a sexual partnership, and when you start to grow and develop, or they start to grow and develop, you start to part, which can actually be quite painful. It doesn't need to be like that, but it can happen. And that's something we need to negotiate very carefully. We also need to make sure that sexual activity is not neurotic. A lot of sexual activity can become very habitual. Neurotic in the sense of using sexual activity to mask feelings of inner poverty, to kind of escape from a sense of inner poverty. As a way of avoiding feelings of loneliness, lack of meaning, dissatisfaction, pain of one kind or another. And the more we kind of use sexual activity to get away from those feelings, the more difficult they're going to be, to engage in. Sex can be a real addiction because we're not facing up to that sort of inner emptiness. And we need to face up to that inner emptiness and more positively to develop an inner life, to develop a rich inner life, which will start to happen if you follow the Dharma. So this brings us to the positive counterpart of the third precept, which is contentment. Contentment. Santushti is the Sanskrit, which is a very strong, very positive word, which perhaps our English word contentment doesn't really convey. Santushti. This state is a very positive, vibrant state of inner wealth and inner richness and radiant sort of awareness, which means that you're quite happy to sit, to be, and that you're not restlessly searching for distraction and entertainment, be it sexual, be it food, be it, you know, surfing on the internet, not necessarily for sexual images, but any kind of images. One of the things about the modern world, it sort of increased the possibility of destroying contentment. You know, there's just so many ways now in which we can avoid sitting and enjoying that inner wealth and inner contentment, that inner richness and well-being. So we need to learn how to sit and be, which is a very difficult practice. It's all present. Learning to see that everything is present. Learning to sit in a chair and, you know, look out of the window at the golden light playing on the green leaves. You know, we can do this here when the sun's shining. You know, and just watching the shadows dancing, you know, across the room or something like that. And even if it grows dark and the rain falls, you know, still seeing, you know, the richness in that, the beauty in that, and you know, being content and at peace without any kind of irritated, restless, you know, searching after something. And one of the ways we can attain this is through simplifying our life. You know, learning how to develop a simpler life, not rushing after desires and distractions, and looking for stillness through a much simpler life. One of the reasons why we have trouble with meditation is because we don't sit and do nothing very often. You know, sometimes people wonder why they're so buzzy when they're meditating, and it's because they've been rushing around before they've gone and meditated. They haven't just sat and just looked and just been. There's the famous story of the Buddha and the king, isn't there? That the Buddha's sitting under a tree one day, and one of his king disciples comes along and asks the question, "Well, who's happier, you or me?" And the Buddha just says, "Well, I'm happier than you." And the king says, "Well, I've got all these possessions. I've got this country, I've got this wealth, I've got elephants, I've got wives, I've got this, I've got that, dancing girls, jewels. I must be happier than you." And the Buddha says, "Well, okay, but could you sit under this tree for an hour without moving and be perfectly happy and content?" And the king actually said he thought he could, you know, for an hour. He thought he probably could do it, which we might have trouble doing. And the Buddha just said, "Well, what about all day?" "Well, that would be difficult. You know, what about all day and all night?" "That would be very difficult." "What about 7 days and 7 nights?" "That would be very, very hard." And the Buddha said, "Well, that's what I could do. I could just sit here all the time and be perfectly happy, perfectly content." So that's what we're looking for. So fourthly, there's abstention from false speech or truthfulness. So this doesn't just mean lying, although obviously lying, you know, this does mean lying. We don't lie, but it means not being false. Why would we be false? Why would we kind of minimise or exaggerate something? Usually because we want to get what we want. We want something. So it's coming from craving or attachment. We don't want to lose something, so we kind of bend the truth so we can hold on to it. You know, we might, if we're really a nasty person, and I'm sure none of you are, we might be false and lie to actually harm others. Sometimes we can't speak the truth. We can't be genuine because we're chronically confused. We don't know what we think, and we don't know what we feel, and we blab on and on and on, but it doesn't actually mean anything. It's empty, meaningless talk. This is why silence is such an important practice within Buddhism. You have an opportunity. Having opportunities not to speak means that you can stay in touch much more with yourself. Find out what you really think, what you really feel about things. And periods of silence again can really help us in meditation, because one of the things you're developing in meditation is a silent mind where there's no mental chatter, going on and on. One of the reasons why we speak so much is because our mind's full of chatter. Speech is very, very, very powerful. We often don't realise how powerful speech is. It affects others and affects ourselves very, very powerfully. It's such a little thing, isn't it? The tongue, the vocal cords, and it's so easy. Well, for some of us, it's so easy to speak. I mean, some people don't find it so easy. I mean, it's never been a problem for me. And it's usually got me into terrible trouble as well. And hindered my spiritual development in so many ways. But the more we speak falsehoods, the more we're living in a lie. We actually, create an artificial world. The more if we speak harshly, or we speak without meaning, or we speak in a way that turns people, maybe unwittingly, against one another, it's doing something to our consciousness. Our mind is becoming like that. Whatever we speak is going to perpetuate the mental states that speech is expressing. When we speak negatively, if we're always moaning or complaining, well, we're going to have a moaning and complaining mind. We're always going to be looking at the sort of, what's wrong with things. We're going to be a bit sort of, probably end up being a bit depressed. If we're speaking harshly or cynically, we're doing that to ourselves as well as to others. We're poisoning the atmosphere around us as well. So we need to be much more aware of our speech and be very clear in our speaking. Be very clear. One of the ways to practice truthfulness, it's not about trying to sort of speak the truth, to speak the profound truths of life. First of all, it just means speaking with factual accuracy. Factual accuracy. Being accurate about what we've done, what we've seen, what we've heard said, and just be very, very clear. Really strive to do this. It's a very powerful practice, and it has a very refreshing effect if you try to make your speech reflect what is. Another thing to do is avoid speaking so certainly about things that we don't really know anything about. I've noticed sometimes in discussion, well, not sometimes, quite often, that if I'm not sure about something, I speak louder, which is a dead giveaway, isn't it? So if I start speaking louder, maybe it means I don't know what I'm talking about. But often we can be very certain about things we don't know anything about. Read it in the paper, seen it on the internet, heard it on the news, seen it on the telly. And, by the time it's come to us, it's about fifth hand. But we could be just perpetuating ignorance and confusion. So we need to watch for that. It's quite a useful exercise to actually ask ourselves, what do I really know? Directly, what do I really know? And try and speak what we really know. It's quite frightening when you contemplate that. But again, a very refreshing exercise. And when we speak generally, really the aim is to speak in a way that enhances others so that they feel uplifted. Truth is not abstract in Buddhism. Truth is always in relation to others. It's always relational. So we need to be true to them. We need to speak in full awareness of them. We're speaking truthfully, but we also need to speak in a helpful and an uplifting kind of way to the other person. Maybe there's something that they do that we need to point out to them. But it's very important to do that in a very, very kindly and helpful way. Truth is never a sort of bludgeon, as far as Buddhism is concerned, that you beat people with. If you're doing that, you're not really being truthful, because you're not being true to them as a human being. And speech can be very positively powerful. You know, if you think about it, speech is an absolutely wonderful thing. I mean, we learn through speech. That's the way we've been educated, through speech. Culture is transmitted through speech, through language. You know, our parents, you know, taught us through speech. You know, perhaps sometimes not in ways we would have liked, but, you know, maybe in ways that have had a very beneficial effect upon us. So speech is a very wonderful thing, and it's prized very strongly in Buddhism. I've mentioned silence, and yes, Buddhist practitioners might have long periods of silence, but vows of perpetual in silence are not permitted in Buddhism because they hinder the propagation, the spread of the Buddha's teaching. Although you might have periods of silence, you've then got to start talking in order to communicate your understanding to others. So the kind of speech we're looking for is not just truthful speech, but kindly speech, harmonious speech, and meaningful speech. And it's these forms of speech that are highly praised in Buddhism, because these kinds of speech really promote the transformation, not just of ourselves, but of others as well. Fifthly, there's abstention from drinks and drugs that cause intoxication. And the principle here is mindfulness. So perhaps the best way to approach this precept is to consider how important mindfulness is in Buddhism. Mindfulness, awareness, is considered to be essential to the path of spiritual development in Buddhism. Without mindfulness and awareness, spiritual progress is impossible. If we're not mindful, if we're not aware, we won't see what we need to give up, we don't see what we need to develop, we won't see where we're going, we won't see what we're doing. So mindfulness is really important to see where we are and where we need to go. So we need, first of all, to cultivate a very strong sense of mindful presence in our lives. We need to learn to be fully in what we're doing. You know, when we're washing up, we're washing up. When we're laying the table, we're laying the table. When we're eating, we're eating. When we're talking to somebody, we're talking to somebody. At the same time, we need to have a very clear sense of purpose and direction, a clear sense of where we're going. So mindfulness isn't just about freezing the present moment. Mindfulness is about having a sense of purpose and direction as well. We also need to connect what we're doing with our spiritual ideal and our spiritual aspiration. You know, are we really expressing our values in what we're doing? So it's a very rich topic, mindfulness and awareness. And if we're not mindful, you know, things, we can really lose our way. If we're not mindful, our speech, for example, can just go out of control. So many of the other precepts can be broken when we lose that sense of mindful presence and purpose. So, if we get intoxicated through drink or drugs, we're very likely to lose this quality of mindfulness. And when we lose this quality of mindfulness, it's very likely that we're going to break the other precepts as well. Some Buddhist traditions say that this precept can be interpreted in terms of moderation. Well, you drink only a little so that you don't get intoxicated. Some Buddhist traditions say very clearly, no drinks, no drugs. In practice, I think it's actually very difficult indeed. Maybe it's impossible to really maintain mindfulness when you've had a drink. There's certainly going to be some blurring, some loss of sensitivity, especially if you don't drink very often. And I know some people abstain completely from drinks and drugs as a sort of Not just for their own benefit, but to also make a sort of statement, because they've seen how much damage drink and drug abuse has caused people in their lives. So they just decide, I'm just not going to do any of it, just to, you know, make a point. When you develop mindfulness really strongly, you probably find that you don't want to drink and you don't want to take drugs. You just don't want to do it, because mindfulness is such a rich experience that makes, you know, any high through drink or drugs look really, you know, like baby's food. Reminds me of a story, actually, of a member of our order before he was ordained. He was really into smoking dope, and he was a very good friend of Sangha Rakshita. And, you know, in those days, Sangha Rakshita was around a lot of people who smoked dope and things like that. And one person, this guy, went on retreat, and somebody had sent some dope along to this retreat for this person, and it was put in this person's room. And they told Sangha Rakshita about it. You know, Sangha Rakshita was very cool about these things in those days. And they'd said, "Well, can you tell so and so that, you know, the dope's in his bedroom?" So Sangha Rakshita went up to this guy and said, you know, very good friends, and he said, "The baby food is in your room." And he said, this person said, "I felt about that big," because he was saying, you know, he was making a point, you know, this is baby food. I mean, compared with what you could, you know, the high you could attain, if you like, through meditation and through insight, this is nothing. This is nothing. I don't know if I should have told that story. Anyway, that was the kind of world of the 1960s. Anyway, so mindfulness is very, very rich. Very, very rich. This is what we need to bear in mind. You know, because sometimes people say, "Well, I want to have my drink. I want to smoke my joints." Yeah, but check this. You know, mindfulness is very, very rich. It's this constant sense of presence. You're just vividly aware of yourself and your world. And that really gives you a much greater sense of beauty and meaning all the time. You're very alert to that, even in the midst of the most mundane, the most ugly of situations. You know, I can remember when I lived in Bombay for a number of years. And Bombay is a very, very rough city. Very ugly city in many ways. But I'm sure if, because I was, you know, meditating and practicing, occasionally, you know, you'd notice something astonishingly beautiful, you know, like a, you know, the colour of a, you know, a really, you know, really sort of disgusting sort of tenement block had this wonderful kind of ochre colour in certain kinds of light of the day. And you'd notice the scarlet hibiscus growing out of the wall or something like that. You know, you were really kind of tuned up to things. So yes, mindfulness can create this vivid awareness. You're vividly aware of the life around you, the animals around you, the people around you. You're much more tuned up to things, much more tuned up to the beingness of everything around you, if you like. Sangha Rakshita on one occasion defined love as awareness of the being of another. Awareness of the being of another. So love and awareness really are the same thing. Metta and awareness are really the same thing in the end. Awareness isn't cold. It's incredibly rich and vibrant. And of course you can have this awareness for yourself, you know, the body and its movements, you know, and practicing things like yoga, tai chi, you know, this kind of thing. You have that sort of sense of the poetry of movement, the dance, if you like, of movement. Just when you're walking along, when you're moving along, just walking along the street, you know. And sometimes, you know, when you've been practicing, you know, you're moving along, and your awareness is just so tuned up. You know, you're just vividly aware of the world around you. You're vividly aware of sensations, emotions, vividly aware of the way you're moving, the sights, the sounds. It's a fantastic, you know, feeling when you get into that, and a great sense of integration. Everything kind of coming together in this very, very strong sense of presence, this sort of pure and total presence. very, very rich indeed. You know, mindfulness and awareness is like a kind of perfume that can pervade all of your experience. And perhaps as well, you start when you start to have that kind of mindfulness and awareness, if you're in it, you know, when you really get into it, you start getting a sense of the sort of deeper mystery of things, the deeper reality of things, even that sense of the becoming that I talked about, you know, around you, the play of conditions, the arising and passing away of conditions. Well, who needs drink and drugs to get high when you have that quality of mindfulness and awareness all the time? The great Tibetan yogi Milarepa, great meditator, speaks in one place of the bliss of the wine of mindfulness. The wine of mindfulness. You know, he doesn't need any kind of external wine because he has this wine of mindfulness and awareness, which is clear and radiant and all pervasive. So perhaps you can see from all this, looking at the five precepts, that Buddhist ethics isn't narrow. It's not a set of rigid rules. But it's behaviour that aligns us with enlightenment. Aligns us with enlightenment. That's what we're doing when we're practicing the precepts. At times we might really struggle. We might really struggle to give up certain things. We might really struggle to develop other things. But keep in mind, you know, this is a training to align ourselves with enlightenment. And, you know, nothing worth doing, you know, anything worth doing is going to take effort, is going to take a struggle. You know, if it's easy, it probably isn't worth doing. And you can see from this too how important practicing the precepts are for our sitting meditation practice. If we're really practicing the precepts, when we actually sit down to meditate, we're already going to be meditating. You know, we're just going to flow into meditation very, very easily, and we can take off.